Hello, Atir. Greetings to friends and allies. God to those of you who are becoming engaged with Planetary Tantra. This is my second audio commentary in the new series of writings, post-correction writings, I call them. Those of you who've been following me on this subject will understand what that means. And those of you who are tuning in, as we go along, we'll pick it up pretty quickly, I believe. As I've remarked before, Planetary Tantra is a flash encounter. It's a smash encounter. It's not something that you get into gradually. It's not something that you sit back on your heels and consider, ponder, evaluate, assess, and reflect if you like it or not. It's been my experience among the people who have come into this practice over the last 2.5 or 3 years that there is an immediate engagement, and the intensity and magic of the process grab you, and you are in it immediately. It's Tantra. It's a non-gradual practice. So I want to also add, as I begin this commentary, that I am operating here in the classroom of cyberspace. As I mentioned before, I'm not particularly at ease with that, and so I may be a little bit halting in my delivery at moments. But also I want to say that there's another reason why I come across in the way I do. This experience I'm having as the Turton of Gaia Awakening is completely unprecedented. I've had plenty of mystical experiences through my life, but nothing like this. Others out there over time and in history, and you as well who are listening, have had your own share of mystical experiences. I'm sure of that. But this particular mystical adventure is unlike any other. Actually, I'm filled with great excitement, with anticipation, with awe, suspense, and many emotions of high intensity are playing in my body and soul as I release this material. So my delivery is affected by the extremes of emotional tonality in which I find myself captured. So to proceed directly with the commentary, I've just posted Reading the Captain's Log, Part 1, subtitled The Mythogenetic Method Demonstrated. And as the introductory paragraph says, in the 7th interview on Planetary Tantra with Grok the Talk, I propose to report on the course of the mothership in correction, specifically by reading from the captain's log as it is being written. This audio commentary explains exactly how I can do that and how you can as well, taking off from my example, if you are so inclined. As I launch into these audio commentaries and this new material post-correction, now there's a nautical metaphor, launch, I'm going to be using a nautical framework. I'm going to be using the allegory of nautical language, if you will, to describe the self-repulsion of the earth through the currents and waters, celestial waters of the galactic arms. And although this description might be called a metaphorical and allegorical, or whatever you wish, it is actually, as far as I know, a literal description of what is taking place. From the moment of correction on, March 19th, 2011, Gaia takes control of the helm of the mother ship, which she is. As I've said, Gaia, the living presence of Sophia within the earth, upon and around the earth, is both the captain of the ship and the ship itself. And so the mothership begins to navigate on its own power and to direct its course according to Sophia's own intentions and designs from the moment of correction onward. And this produces immediately massive global changes and also massive interpsychic changes in the individual and collective psychic fields of human beings, in the individual and collective psychic fields simultaneously. So I'll use the nautical metaphor in that sense, but bear in mind that it's much more than just a metaphor. One word that's very helpful for this metaphor, for this nautical description of Gaia's correction, is yaw. It's a term that means to swerve off course momentarily, as a ship will do when it is plowing into heavy seas, or when it is changing its course relative to very strong currents. This is exactly what the planetary mothership is doing right now. And if you want any verification of what I'm saying, then just spend a little time looking around on the internet at the reports we find, largely in the alternative media, for the most extraordinary things that are happening here on the planet, such as vast cracks appearing in different places around the world, such as a massive amount of tectonic activity, which I would be very cautious about attributing to HARP or attributing to human sources. Some of it, I grant, some part of it, some portion of this increased tectonic activity might be due to human meddling. But by and large, I am convinced that the great majority of these events, of these earth changes and geophysical changes, are due to the fact that the mother ship is actually undergoing a certain strain as she pulls into her new course. Rather than more or less drifting with the current of the solar system and drifting with the overall pattern of ships in the fleet of the solar system, she is taking her own course, and as she does, she'll take the solar system with her. And we can actually observe how this happens, and we can plot it by the positions, relative positions of the planets to the Earth from the moment of correction onward. I've already suggested a little bit, given some slight indications about how we might do that. You know, it's one thing to say, as I've said before, and this is a standard feature of Gnostic instruction, the planetary system exclusive of the Sun, Moon, and Earth is an archontic, inorganic celestial mechanics. The Earth, Moon, and Sun form a three-body system that is totally alive and interactive. That three-body system is captured in this solar system of the other planets. Fine, that is the description, or my paraphrase, taken directly from Gnostic sources. But that's not the only way to look at the capture of the three body, of the Gaian three body system in the archontic system. In fact, I want to suggest that in post correction, we consider another way to imagine and describe the situation, simply like this. The Earth is a ship sailing in a fleet of ships. The mothership is part of a fleet which involves the archontic planets such as Saturn, Mars, and Jupiter. But the Earth, being a living being and being the incarnate vehicle of a divine super organism, an aeon, can do whatever it wants within this archontic system. And so with Gaia awakening, she can use those archontic planets in any way she likes in order to achieve her correction. For example, she can take the planet Jupiter as a tug. And she can use the massive effect of the planet Jupiter. It's the most massive of the planets in the solar system. She can use the gravitational and electromagnetic pull of Jupiter for her own advantage, to swing herself around onto her right course. And you'll see, if you look very closely at the configurations of the day of correction, March 19th, that there was an alignment with Jupiter in its own perihelion, that is to say, the point closest to the sun, which facilitated the mothership in just exactly that way. And so Gaia, as the pilot and ship, can use Jupiter as a tug, and I would suggest also, pursuing the nautical analogy, that she uses Saturn as a kind of lightship. You know, there are such things as sailing lighthouses, lighthouses that are actually mounted on boats. And they're called lightships. And Gaia can, for her own purposes, use Saturn as a lightship. Use Saturn in order to take a certain bearings regarding the overall environment in which she travels. So as you can see, this nautical analogy is pretty fantastic. It can be applied toward current geophysical events and the anomalies that are happening more and more by the dozens and dozens every day, the physical anomalies of the planet, the physical anomalies of the radiation pouring from the sun, the physical anomalies in the observation of the sun and the moon. All of these can be put in the framework of this nautical metaphor. And at the same time, we can begin to understand the solar system in an entirely different dynamic and understand the role of the archonic planets, which on the one hand impose a false holographic reality upon the Earth, but at the same time can be used by the planetary animal mother in any way that she likes, because she is and always has been sovereign aeonic power, standing very high over the archons. Now, in this essay, I set out how the mythogenetic method works, and I'm going to try to follow what I've written in what I say now, in order to present you with some user-friendly material and demonstrate some continuity between the oral and the written parts of this exercise. As I note, I've explained a number of things already about the lunar apsides, the barycenter, and the mechanism of the lunar apsides as they function as the steerage or helm and rudder construct for the planet Earth. And you'll find some of that also explained on the talks on planetary tantra on Grok the Talk. What I have not disclosed so far are a number of things, topmost of which is the location of the moon and the location of the apsides of the moon. That is to say, its near point, the perigee, and its far point, the apogee. The actual location of these points in the constellations. This is something that can be observed, and at the same time, if you're going to practice the mythogenetic method, you bring an act of imagination to what you are observing. And then what happens? Well, you don't do anything after that. You just bring the act of imagination to the act of observation. This is what the alchemists called, this is why the alchemists called alchemy the spagyric art. Spagyric, S-P-A-G-Y-R-I-C. Spagyric is this strange word that is found in medieval alchemy. I think spagyric, S-P-A-G-Y-R-I-C. I think Paracelsus uses it. And it's one of the many made-up words you find in those texts. It is a neologism. It is mongrel dog Latin, which the alchemists used. What it actually means is to combine or spin together things which ordinarily would not be combined. So ordinarily, because we have the first attention in which we observe the world in a logical and linear fashion, and then we have the second attention through which we dream and fantasize about the world, we do not normally combine those functions. They may overlap, they may compete with each other, they may fight with each other, at times they may harmonize, but they are distinctly different functions. Linear, real-time, logical attention to what's in front of you, and the act of dreaming or reverie. One good way in which they combine, which is very pleasant, because they do sometimes combine on their own, is the experience of taking a long drive. I love to take long drives, and I used to take them in the United States a lot. It's a country where you can drive for many, many, many miles in a kind of meditation. You remain in the first attention because you're driving, and you got to pay attention to running the vehicle. You stay on the road, you follow the signs, you follow the speed limit, you stay in continuity with the course to your destination. If you're going to drive from Santa Fe to L.A., you take the right routes, you get off at the right exits, and all this is linear logic attention, the first attention. But at the same time, because it doesn't take so much of the first attention to do that and to maintain the right level of consciousness that you are driving a car to a certain destination, you can allow the second attention to roll in like clouds rolling over the horizon. And the second attention is a process of reverie, dreaming, imagination, floating in and out of emotional moods. And so in that case, it's one of the examples when the first attention and the second attention sort of merge and mingle with each other. But generally speaking, functionally speaking, they are quite distinct. And the divine art of alchemy was a spagyric art of bringing observation and imagination together. When you do that, something automatically happens. You don't have to do anything else but that. A dynamic is produced by that combination, by consciously bringing them together. And so, when you work out in your linear mind, where is the moon, what is the day of the month, what is the degree of the moon, all of these linear logical factors, and then you go out and observe the moon in the sky and picture the constellations that are involved in its motion, you are doing the spagyric art of divine alchemy. You are combining observation and imagination, and it produces automatically very powerful effects in your psyche. So, fine, let's say that much is clear. Now, how do you get into this process of adding the imaginative component? Well, the first thing to do is to get the imaginations, the imaginative pictures, what I call the graphics of the constellations, down so that you recognize what they are. That's not difficult to do because I provide the material for that in the so-called rim sight design. And the rim sight design is just my rendering, my drawings, developed over quite a number of years, of the 13 constellations on the path of the Earth and the Sun and the Moon. And this is where all the solar, lunar, and planetary activity occurs. So these are the constellations of the zodiac. They're not the only constellations in the sky. There are extra zodiacal constellations above and beneath these. But primarily, these are the ones we learn to observe first, and we follow them through the year by the so-called coastlining method, which you'll also find explained here on the site. Now, to get started, we look at the constellation of the fishes, which can also be called the whales. You'll see here that I've blocked out from the rim sight, that particular constellation, which is of key interest right now because that is where the apogee of the moon is currently located. That is to say, each month in its circle around the Earth, when the moon reaches the point where it is most distant from the Earth, It is passing through the constellation of the fishes, as shown here. So you see a moon, meaning aphelion moon, and the little arrow shows that the direction that the moon moves through the constellations, and also the direction that the aphelion, the apogee itself moves, which I'll get to in a moment. And there are some other details on this, in this illustration, which are explained in the paragraph below. You see the movement of the planet Jupiter there, and you see the indication of the Andromeda galaxy relative to the fish that is leaping up and away from the ecliptic. And you see the planet Uranus, which is located beneath the fin of the fish swimming along the ecliptic. Planet Uranus, by the way, is the first planet beyond Saturn. The three planets beyond Saturn are called Uranus, Neptune, and Pluto. And they are generally included as members of the solar system. But in the Gnostic cosmology and in the Sophianic framework of cosmology that I am currently presenting, they are not considered to be planets of the solar system at all. They don't belong to the solar system. The limit of the solar system is the orbit of the planet Saturn. And what then are Uranus, Neptune, and Pluto? Well, they are something like probes. They are probes that have been sent to our solar system. By whom? Well, I would venture to say they have not been sent by extraterrestrials from other civilizations on planets circulating other stars in the galactic limbs. I would venture to say that they might be monitored and used by such civilizations in order to make observations of the Earth and the divine experiment on Earth over long periods of time. But I would venture to say, and I just present this as a proposition to be considered, that these probes actually represent the extension of the pleromic observers from the center of the galactic core. At the galactic core are the aeons, and Sophia herself was one of these aeons and is. And when she departed from the galactic core into the great adventure that turned her into this planet, the pleromic aeons who remained in the observation booth, as it were, did not venture out with her and become enmeshed in the experiment here on Earth. But they take a keen interest in it. And I propose to you that these three Transaturnian planets, Uranus, Neptune, and Pluto, are rather like observational probes that they have established on the perimeter of the solar system in order to monitor and observe what is happening in our world here. So, to return to the main theme or the main objective of this essay, I would like to explain how the mythogenetic method works and how to practice it. The way to practice it is to make these observations and to look at the observable sky, to stand there and be involved with the sky, but at the same time, in your imagination, to picture those great graphic constellations and to allow them to catalyze in your imagination, in your psyche, certain insights. Now, I've been doing this for most of my life, for over 40 years, easily, 40, 45 years. And I've also had the privilege of having the time to immerse myself in sidereal mythology and to study the sky lore of all the cultures of the world and to accumulate a large repertoire of themes and associations for each of these zodiacal constellations. So I have a repertoire in mind when I look at the fishes and when I look at the crab or when I look at the twins, to use their Greco-Latin names. And you don't have that. And that may seem like a tremendous disadvantage. And perhaps up until now it has been. But I can assure you that it will not be a disadvantage for much longer. The way that this class in stellar mythology works between me and you, whoever you may be, is that I present the material that I have accumulated and, in a certain respect, mastered as far as a mythopoetic genre can be mastered. But you don't operate simply on the material that you receive from me, because your psyche is permeated with these same stellar archetypes, if you wish to use that term. They originate in your psyche just as much as they originate in mine. So the fact that I have a more practiced and long-term familiarity with them gives me the ability to talk with you about them. But at the same time, the real art here is for you to discover the activation of these stellar archetypes in your own psyche and your own imagination. And that will happen simply by performing this exercise. You don't have to do what I did. You don't have to spend years and years studying the comparative mythology of the stars, which is an extremely difficult and challenging and daunting subject and very exasperating and confusing. Don't have to do that, because with correction and with the immediate perfection of the mythogenetic method, it becomes a spontaneous discovery process for everyone who engages in it. Now, if we look at this section here under the subheading Gaian Recall, you can see how the teacher, the Turton, from his familiarity with these materials, has put together a certain, what is called a mythography. A mythography means that you take a constellation like the lion and you add to it mythological content. So the lion is a certain set of stars, a composite of stars, and the lion is recognized by its signature, which is the form that strikes the eye based on the brightest stars in that constellation. The signature of the lion is a reverse question mark on the right, with a kind of a long arcing curve on the left, representing the body of the lion and culminating in the tail star, the nebula. So you have the composite stars of the lion, some 40 or 50 stars. You have the signature of the lion, which is what you see, the dot-to-dot thing you see in the sky. And then you have the graphics, which is how the lion is drawn and represented. Additional to those three components, you have the content of that constellation, the mythography. That is to say, what are the motifs and what are the legends and the myths and the mythological figures that could be put in the category under the rubric of the lion, such as Sekhmet, the lion-headed Egyptian goddess, or such as Hercules, the lion hero, or Credo Mutwa, the lion shaman of the Zulu, and all of the lore of the lion that you find in various cultures goes into the category of mythography of the lion. So what I've done here under Gaian Recall is given you some mythography of the fishes, just a glimpse. And I point out that one thing that is really important about the fishes I've discovered is that not only is this an enormously large constellation, it's the second largest after the Virgin, which is opposite, but it relates to very, very key events in the prehistory of the prehistory of humanity and key events in the Sophianic vision story. One of those events, as you know from reading my book and this site, is the so-called Christic intervention. That's the moment when the aeons in the Pleroma saw that Sophia, having been metamorphosed into a planet, was bursting with life, and that she could not manage the diversity of the life forms in her biosphere, in the biological matrix. The diversity of species was overwhelming to her. And so they sent from the Pleroma, another aeon, known as the Christos, not to be associated with Jesus Christ or anything in the salvationist paradigm, but an aeon, a superhuman being that never assumed a human form and never incarnated on earth, and in fact came to Sophia's rescue before any human beings were even present on the planet. And that was in the era right after the Cambrian explosion, which traditionally is placed around 585 million years ago. So it's interesting. We can do this tentatively and provisionally. I do not accept that the geological timescale that I'm using here is correct. So I may sound like a hypocrite to you, but I'm using it only as a provisional and tentative element in a mythopoetic process. Don't get hung up on the metaphors. When you get the message, hang up the phone. Although they are precarious and provisional, these kind of associations, these correlations, if you will, between the mythography of the zodiac and science, biology, physics, mathematics, anthropology, botany, and so forth, are extremely rich and enlightening and instructive. But it's all just an exercise, folks. It's not supposed to be a rigid dogmatic system. It's supposed to be a practice that brings you into deep participation with the earth. That's the point of it. It's not the point of accumulating knowledge for its own sake, but it's knowledge that takes you somewhere. Sacred knowledge always takes you somewhere. Sacred knowledge is always an application of what is known to experience, and it immediately and vividly transforms experience. And this is more and more provable in the practice of Planetary Tantra. You see on the next page here is a illustration with French words of the constellation of Andromeda, which shows some of the details of that constellation. And it also shows the position of M31. You see, it's right there on the chain around her belt. M31 is the Andromeda galaxy, which is actually located, it's an external galaxy. It's our neighbor. It's 2.2 million light years away, if you want to buy that paradigm of distance measurable in light years. Again, I'm not even saying that's correct. But since that is an installed software that we have been given, we'll use it for our purposes. If it serves us and takes us somewhere, fine, and then we'll discard it. Or else we will discard it if it doesn't prove to be useful. But right now, let's just say provisionally, this proves to be useful. We know, we can confirm by observation, that when you look up at the constellation of Andromeda, which is above the fishes, and you sight down from the star Alpheretz and the head star, two stars down to Mu Andromeda, and then you sight one star up to Nu Andromeda, and you look just slightly off to the right and up from that star, you will see a faint smudge in the sky. It looks like the merest thumbprint, and it looks to be a pale mauve, or a kind of color of smoked horn, as it has been described. It's a smoky, pale horn color with a mauve tint. And it's very, very faint. It looks like a thumbprint. And you can actually see it better if you avert your eyes slightly from it. When you see that, you're looking at the most distant object visible to the naked eye. That is a massive galaxy twinned to our galaxy. It is the mirror galaxy to ours. But it is somewhat larger by about a third and 9 times less dense. So that's the Andromeda Galaxy, an amazing place to go and spend your vacations. Next illustration is from the Star Atlas of Elijah Byrd, and it shows how he represented, based on the zodiacal drawings of Albert Dürer from a woodcut of 1520, Burt represented the two fishes, one of which is leaping up towards Andromeda, and you can see that the direction of the fish and the whole movement and construction of the constellation of the fishes actually serves to point toward the Andromeda galaxy. Why is that? Well, it's not because it was designed that way by cosmic powers, because as a matter of fact, the whole perception of this globe, this englobing circle of stars, is relative to our place on Earth. What we see when we look out at the constellations is only about 3 or 4% of all the stars in the galaxy. So it's a tiny bubble of observable stars, observable by the naked eye. And so what we're seeing are, in a sense, very relative, very arbitrary patterns. But ancient seers who were able to perceive the structure of the cosmos on a macro scale knew about these things. And so in order to teach their neophytes how to detect certain things in the sky, they would point to an area of stars, say, that we now call the fishes, before it was called the fishes. And they would just point to it, and they would say, look at this area of stars over here. Just scan your eyes around this general area. And when the student had become accustomed to looking at the general area, that is what I call the composite stars of that group, the teacher would say, the Egyptians were particularly good at this, now just take your eyes away and bring them back again quickly and tell me which stars stand out. And then they would show the neophyte by a series of exercises that the eye naturally selects, will naturally select certain bright stars. And so after, for instance, the brightest star in the constellation of fishes is the one at the cord, at the knot of the cord that unites the two fishes. The other stars in the constellation of fishes are relatively dim. So after the priest astronomer, if you will, on the roof of an Egyptian temple pointed this out, they would say, okay, now you have a point of orientation within that composite. Now I'm going to tell you how to perceive and compose the rest of it into a signature. Into a signature. And they would actually tell the student how to visualize the fishes. And then they would say, can you visualize those composite stars in that shape? And the student would eventually say yes, and they would say, okay, now I'll tell you something really neat. If you follow the shape of the leaping fish, if you let your eye follow that, and you go up to just a little bit above the nose of the fish, ping, there's the Andromeda Galaxy. So this is how it was taught, you see. These constellations were designed to be perceived in a certain way. The designs were intentionally taught and constructed by the masters of stargazing who understood the large-scale structure of the universe and many, many things that we in modern science is only discovering in recent decades. Now, we're just at 38 minutes here, and already most of the way through this audio commentary. And what I'd like to do now, I don't want to go beyond 50 minutes, is take the rest of the time to do what I told you I was going to do, which I don't know exactly how to do. At the moment I said I was going to do it, it was clear. I said, in the audio commentary, I will explain how and why this method works. Well, perhaps I have already done that to some extent to your satisfaction, but I think not completely. So let me see if I can fill it in. Now, this is a challenge. I'm going to take a big chance here. I'm going to operate on the assumption, or my assumption, that the best way to convey this to you is to plunge right to the absolute core and essence of this process. In order to do that, I would like to explain to you my experience of reading the constellations up until March of 2011. I spent, as I said, a great deal of my life trying to decode the zodiac, and I wrote a book about it called Quest for the Zodiac. And in decoding the zodiac over those many years, in studying the comparative stellar mythology, blah, 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 I always operated on a basic premise. I had to tell myself what I was doing And often I couldn't tell myself what I was doing. I got completely lost and overwhelmed in the material. But when I came to my senses, I always told myself the same thing. I said, what am I doing? Well, I'm actually just using these constellations as a kind of file system in order to accumulate this received material and in order to read this received material. So there's a certain amount of received material that fits into the Pisces file, into the file of the fishes, including this, the myth of Andromeda, because Andromeda is above the fishes and graphically related to it, as you've just seen. So I said, okay, I'm just going to consider the zodiacal constellations as a sort of memory bank of passively recorded material. I'm looking into the past. It's Starhenge. I'm looking into the distant past, and in the images of these constellations, the phylogenetic memory of the human species has been recorded. That is the racial memory. This is what Jung grappled with so much, and he was never able to arrive at a satisfactory definition of how the phylogenetic memory works or how the archetypes are actually transmitted. But I discovered that the archetypes are held and transmitted in the stellar frequencies of these constellational images. So, when I read the constellations, I was in fact like reading cuneiform tablets. I was reading a text, the cosmic code. But here's the key point. Here's the difference between then and now. Before, I was reading them as a passive record of recorded material. Now, since correction, I read them in a completely different way. And the way that you can learn to read them by following my example is completely different. That's why no one has to go back and do what I did. It's completely passé. You may do that. You may, for your pleasure or your instruction, read a few books on sidereal mythology. Unfortunately, there aren't any good ones, really. But you can nourish and nourish your mind with reading mythology and then refer it to this framework. You can do that, but you don't have to, because the whole process is now in an entirely different mode. Now, when I am reading for you now the constellation of the fishes, I am reading it as it is being read and recalled in the active memory of the planet itself. I want you to get this difference. This is why the method works, and this is how the method works today in a way that it could not possibly ever have worked before. Even for the great initiates of the past, in the mysteries, who were masters of star lore and masters of naked eye astronomy and naked eye mythology, even they couldn't read it in this way. The opportunity that we have today is absolutely unprecedented and fabulous beyond any description. So when I now proceed to demonstrate to you how to read the stellar code, to demonstrate the mythogenetic method, as I'm going to do in these pieces on the captain's log, I am going to be reading the memory of Gaia as she herself recapitulates her experience. The ultimate act of a shaman of the Nahual who stands on the border between this world and the other is to do just that. To stand on the interface of the worlds, the natural and the supernatural world. That is the ultimate art of a Nahual dedicated to Gayan Tantra and Gayan Shamanism. And I am only the first to practice that art and to demonstrate it. It can and will erupt spontaneously in the hearts and psyches of people as the correction of Sophia unfolds. Her correction releases an eruption of the luminous epinoia through the circuits of the human psyche. And in order to be in line of that massive wave of imaginative illumination, there's only one thing that you have to do, my friends. You have to take the Gayan Tantric vow, that is to make a personal pact with the goddess, just as you would with anybody that you're, make an agreement with anybody that you were working with. You're going to work with her, you're going to play with her, make a pact with her. And in keeping that pact, learn her story. Because as I said in the previous audio commentary, the story arc of the Sophianic myth is the only story about this planet that will root your NLP to source. Because it is a story about the source. All the other stories that you may hear, the Pleiadian channelings, the theosophical and anthroposophical scenarios, and are not stories about her. They are not her biography. It is only her biography, her unique planetary adventure, told in the story arc of the fallen goddess scenario that will root your NLP to the source of power of your own imagination and even of your own life. Even of your own life. And so your engagement in that story is the most empowering act that you as a human being can perform. And in doing so, you gain the humility of recognizing that that is your life. Your life is in her story, or it isn't anywhere. Because you don't have a life of your own. I don't have one of my own. That is liberation, not to have a life of your own, but to find your life in the greater framework of her story. That is liberation. That is privilege. That is the most fantastic opportunity that I could possibly present to you. And so this is what we are doing here. Post-correction. When I read to you in the coming weeks, when I decode or read what is being written in the captain's log, it's as if I'm leaning over the captain's shoulder, reading as she writes in the log. For instance, there's something coming up in 2012, very early in the spring, a momentous part of Gaia's recapitulation, a momentous part of her recall. And I can't tell you, I can sort of tell you what that is, and I'll do that in the next audio talk, but I can't, at this moment, recall that recall. Because I can only recall it in real time with her as she recalls it. So this is how the decoding of the zodiac proceeds in an entirely different way than it did in the past. In the past, you could say, if I put it in a rather dismissive way, it was a matter of armchair scholarship. It was a matter of comparative mythology. You say, okay, Eliade did this, and Joseph Campbell did this, and like John Lash did that, and he compiled all these things and decoded the zodiac and tells us that it's a record of the phylogenetic memory of the species, and that is all just academic scholarship. But it's a rich foundation for what can be done now, which is to read the zodiac in real time, concurrent with Gaia's recapitulation of her own experience. Now, why should she have to recapitulate her experience? I have just a few more minutes here to bring up something that is absolutely and totally mind-blowing. And if I have my sanity about me and my wits about me, I'll be able to pick up this thread in some other writing or commentary and elaborate on it a little more. But for right now, allow me to leave you dangling with this thread. How can it be, you might ask, that a super, super, super organism, super divine pleromic entity of magnitude of consciousness and sentience and perception and intelligence beyond anything that you can imagine, could have forgotten where she was going? Well, this is what the story says. This is what it means by her disconnection from the pleromic center. She got very, very involved in what happened to her when she fell into the divine experiment of the Anthropos in the three-body system, when she fell into her own unilateral dreaming. And the operative word there, my friends and allies, is unilaterally. See? Because there is a law, a cosmic law, among the aeons, which is stated in a Valentinian exposition, one of the Nag Hammadi texts, that the originator, who is the source of all the pleromic aeons, or generators, the originator wishes that all things and experiments in the universe be brought about through a syzygy, that is, through a dyad. He wants the originator, it, or he, excuse me, the originator, which is the one unity behind all the galaxies, wants the pleromic generators in each galaxy to produce experiments dyadically, two at a time, the Tantra buddy system. But it's not an absolute rule, because the originator leaves the generators totally free to do as they wish. Well, what does the myth tell us? No other myth comes anywhere near telling us things like this. Believe me, nothing comes close to this. This is the cosmic perspective for you to see what is right in front of your nose. The myth says that Sophia acted unilaterally without a consort when she enmeshed herself in the divine experiment with us in a three-body system. And in doing so, she broke continuity of consciousness with the pleromic eons. Now, once you have that on board, go just a little bit further to this. When I first realized the capacity to converse with Gaia, to converse with the planetary intelligence as if it were another person in a two-way conversation, that happened on Infinity Ridge in June of 2002. And that was 9 years ago. And when that happened, I was stunned by a number of things. You can't imagine. But I was really stunned overall and above all by one impression. When I got her attention, I realized that she was autistic. But I couldn't get her attention because she was autistic until I realized that she was. Now, if you want Gaia's attention, you must realize that she was or is autistic. And this autism of Gaia, Sophia, is a cosmic autism. She fell into cosmic autism. What is cosmic autism? It is the macrocosmic expression of human autism. What is human autism? It is unilateral reality making. The autistic child lives in a world entirely of its own. It creates unilaterally, and it has extraordinary powers of creation, invention, counting, photographic memory, but it does it all in isolation from anyone else. And so, Gaia fell into an autism, but with correction, she comes out of autism. And as she comes out of autism, let me tell you, she comes out of autism on a run like you wouldn't believe. She comes out of autism very, very rapidly. And I could even suggest the moment when she will come completely out of autism. I can suggest the timing of what that moment would be. So she comes out of autism, but as she pulls out of autism into more and more interactivity with us, with the Anthropos, or those members of the Anthropos who are there to meet her, she recapitulates the experiences that brought her to the state where she is now. She recapitulates them, so just like us, so that she can understand how to best achieve her correction. And in this process of recapitulation, which I can track in real time through the movement of the apogee of the moon through the constellations, and I can describe, and I shall describe, in this Gaian recapitulation process, at certain moments, huge chunks of her memory fall into place. Huge chunks of things that she forgot, in a sense. She never really forgot them, but they were relegated to a distant part of her mind, as it were, because of her concentration upon the processes of being a planet and dealing with the diversity of species and with the archons and with the human situation in her own inner fantasy world of autism. Now she can do everything that she did in that autistic state by turning outward. But she has to go through a recapitulation process, which will only take about some months, not a very long time. And during that time, those of us who are in the navigational crew have the absolutely extraordinary opportunity to follow that recapitulation. So that's why I say, in the practice of this method, I can only recall her experience as she recalls it. And it is that which I am now in the course of doing. So thank you, and we'll proceed with this material pretty rapidly in the next few days.